dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this week
you're listening to episode 706 of Unwelcome Guests. When are terrorists not terrorists? I'm Robin Upton. And the answer to that, of course, is not on their days off, but when they control the state. A reference to a definition of terrorism I found a dozen or so years ago. I looked up and it occurred quite specifically, it's acts of violence to pursue ideological political ends when they're committed by non-state actors. Neatly avoiding the discussion about state terrorism, because according to that definition, it doesn't exist. I looked that up, by the way, when some Muslims in the East End of London had been arrested and charged with trying to make bombs. They hadn't actually made or let off any bombs. Nevertheless, the BBC chose to intersperse that footage with a video of some bombs going off in Madrid. So we had real people suffering real bomb attacks shown on the television as part of a report about some people being taken into custody, being charged with making bombs. Now that prompted me to see, what is the BBC actually doing here? Could that in itself be called an act of terrorism? And no, because it's by the state apparatus, that could perhaps be called terrorisation, but terrorism was excluded. So this week, the focus on the use of terror to keep people afraid, not by independent organisations or even false flag covertly funded opposition groups, but by paid-up nation states. So the US, as I see it, could easily be accused of terrorising Pakistanis because it has drones over Pakistan ready to rain down death at a moment's notice. Now, quite apart from the terror of those who are the victims of murderous attacks, just the knowledge that the drones are there must exert a terrorizing effect on entire populations. Is it a stretch of the imagination to think that research is being carried out, even now, into the effects of terrorizing people? With a view to using drones worldwide. We've noted before on the programme, the last time we had a show about drones, it was episode 661, that restrictions on drones in US airspace have been rolled back, and my research for Wikispooks has uncovered the fact that in December 2014, a deal was struck by the Italian Air Force and the police forces to use Italian Reaper drones to monitor soccer games and demonstrations in Italian cities. While we're on the subject of new technologies for surveilling the population, this year it's been announced in the US that handheld radar is being used to see through walls, originally developed for use in Iraq and Afghanistan, now being used by the US Marshals Service. X-ray vans have been used, continue to be used by the New York Police Department, and the DEA is the go-to group for coordinating a national network of license plate readers, with hundreds of millions of records on file, according to a recent FOIA request. And just last week, the UK police apparently uploaded 18 million mugshots to a facial recognition database, which, given a photograph, can get an exact match in a matter of seconds. Now, that's not necessarily terrorism, as we normally understand it. That could be just seen as cost-efficient law enforcement. That's certainly how it's being presented. If we had complete confidence that there were technological systems and laws in place to prevent the abuse of such power, and that these laws were being adhered to, by people of high moral integrity, then I think the case could probably be made that this is not about terrorization, this is just mass surveillance. Now, I'm not saying that I would try and make that case, and I'm certainly not saying that I believe the officials atop these hierarchies are possessed of great integrity. Whilst I do believe that there are good people everywhere inside these hierarchies trying to get out, it is a proven research finding that corporate hierarchies tend to be dominated at the higher levels by psychopaths and sociopaths, and this is going to be even more true for politicians, I would have thought, and especially intelligence agencies. And the working hypothesis that all these large hierarchies are more or less in thrall to the deep state seemed to me to explain the available evidence. Facts such as why has nobody on the commercially controlled media picked up the issue of wrongdoing by the intelligence agencies? Why have such legal challenges as have been mounted ended up with officially approved legal decisions at the highest level that black is white? No, torture is not a breach of human rights. We don't need any evidence to lock people up, throw away the key. Yes, people can be assassinated without need of presenting any explanation. Trials can be carried out in secret. So this is nothing new, but if you thought that the situation as far as drones is that there's some legal statute somewhere on the books which all look relatively clear as crystal, they just not happen to be being followed by the people on the ground, well, then we're going to learn that this is actually quite far from the case. Because, as we shall hear from a couple of speakers at a conference on murder by drones from earlier this year, it's increasingly not a matter of public record who has killed whom and with what supposed justification. Obama claimed in a recent speech that some guidelines have been produced and the whole guidelines have not been released. It's classified. National security is increasingly being quoted as an answer to all questions, i.e. no, we're not going to give any specific details about what happened. And never mind plausible deniability, people are not being put in a position of having to state on the record what actually happened. We're going to start the show this week with Bruce Gagnon speaking in October 2014 to give us an insight into the power of big money and military contractors to steamroller existing laws, ethics, safeguards in pursuit of profit.
Our next speaker is Bruce Gagnon, the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Mr. Gagnon is a recipient of the Benjamin Spock Peacemaker Award. He was featured on 60 Minutes for organizing a campaign which protested the launch of 72 pounds of plutonium into space in 1997 on the Cassini space mission. In 2003, Bruce co-produced a popular video entitled Arsenal of Hypocrisy that spells out U.S. plans for space domination. In 2006, he produced another video entitled The Necessity of the Conversion of the Military-Industrial Complex.
Good evening, everyone. I live in Bath, Maine, where Navy destroyers are built. These ships are outfitted with so-called missile defense systems that the Pentagon today is using to help surround Russia and China. Few people in my community, including activists, are particularly interested in where these ships will go or what their military mission is. It's not popular to raise these questions, especially when Bath Iron Works is the largest industrial employer in our state. In the U.S. today, 59 cents of every federal discretionary tax dollar goes to the Pentagon to fund the cancerous war machine. Our communities have become addicted to military spending as our physical and social infrastructure continues to deteriorate. There is virtually no money for anything else these days as we witness austerity cuts in social programs here in this country and all around the globe. The Pentagon says that America's role under corporate globalization of the world economy will be security export. We won't have conventional jobs making useful things in our communities. Instead, we will build weapons for endless war and send our kids overseas to die on behalf of oil corporations. In fact, today, weapons are the number one industrial export product of the U.S. And when weapons are your number one industrial export product, what is your global marketing strategy for that product line? What does it say about the soul of our nation that we have to keep selling weapons and killing people around the globe in order to provide jobs for workers so they can feed their families? In addition to coordinating the global network, I'm also a member of Veterans for Peace. And just days ago, we completed a low-tech 125-mile walk across parts of our state that we called Walk for Peace and a Sustainable Future. Increasingly, the only real job investment money coming into Maine and across the nation from the federal government is for military weapons production. So now nearly 10% of Maine's economy is reliant on weapons contracts. We began the walk up in the beautiful mountains and lake region called Rangeley, where the Pentagon's Missile Defense Agency is considering putting up to 60 so-called missile defense interceptors, which in fact are key elements in U.S. first strike attack planning and are aimed at Russia and China. Narrow, winding roads would have to be bulldozed and widened, and huge holes would have to be blasted into the mountains in order to insert the missile silos. Toxic fuel would be trucked in and stored on site, the same rocket fuel that is now contaminating water sources in 22 states across the nation. The whole plan would be an environmental disaster and would cost taxpayers more than $4 billion. This program is an important illustration of how our nation increasingly puts blind trust and faith in space technology to fight modern wars. Come to find out, the Pentagon didn't even want this expensive program, but pressure on Congress from the Boeing Corporation forced it to go forward with an environmental impact statement process in public hearings in four states, including Maine, to select an East Coast deployment site for the missile defense base. Another major weapons program being built that the Pentagon didn't actually want, it's also in Bath, Maine, where I live. General Dynamics Corporation owns Bath Iron Works, where the destroyers for the Navy are built. The standard destroyer previously cost $1.5 billion each and is outfitted with another version of these missile defense interceptor missiles, which have had much success in their testing program. But after Obama became president, he forced the Pentagon to build the new high-tech stealth destroyer that they call the Zumwalt class destroyer, the job of which is to sneak up on China and blast it with an electromagnetic railgun and other weapon systems. This is part of Obama's pivot of 60% of U.S. military forces into the Asia-Pacific to provocatively confront and control China. As it turns out, the majority stockholders of the General Dynamics Corporation are the Crown family in Chicago, who helped Obama get elected to the presidency. So we owed them. And the new Zumwalt stealth destroyer, at a cost to taxpayers of between $4 to $6 billion per copy, is their reward. As part of the U.S. pivot to China, The Pentagon needs more airfields for warplanes, more barracks for troops, and more ports of call for ships being deployed into the Asia Pacific. So in places like Jeju Island, South Korea, we see a 500-year-old farming and fishing culture being torn apart, and UNESCO recognized World Heritage soft coral reefs just offshore being destroyed as a Navy base is being built for U.S. nuclear subs, aircraft carriers, and the destroyers made in my hometown of Bath. Endangered coral reefs in the Philippines, Australia, Hawaii, Okinawa, and other places are similarly being severely impacted by U.S. military expansion across the region. The global network is working hard to build international support for the local struggles against U.S. military devastation of the environment and the way of life in these communities. The Pentagon has the largest carbon footprint on the planet today. But sadly, there is little acknowledgement of that fact by most climate change groups, which well illustrates, I believe, the off-limits nature of the growing military domination of our society. Some environmental leaders have told me over the years that they don't want to negatively impact their positive working relationship with Democrats in Congress by taking on the more controversial military issues, which most Democrats fully support because they bring jobs to their districts. We've become an occupied nation. The corporate oligarchy that runs the show in Washington uses space-based technologies to spy on us and to direct all warfare on the planet. In a way, you could call today's expensive military satellites the triggers that make the high-tech weapons like drones and missiles work. These satellites allow the military to see everything on the Earth, to hear everything on the Earth, and to target virtually every place on the planet. The military-industrial complex has become the primary resource extraction service for corporate capitalism and is preparing the future generations for its dead-end street of endless war. In the U.S., approximately 40% of all scientists, engineers, and technical professionals currently work in the military sector. This is a colossal waste of talent and intellectual resources as we face the coming reality of climate change. Due to the fiscal crisis across the nation, engineering, computer science, mathematics, astronomy, and chemistry departments in colleges and universities have become increasingly dependent on military funding. We're sold the line that high-tech robotic warfare will save American lives and will be a cheaper way to fight. One key reason for the militarization of space is also as a resource extraction strategy so that they can go out to the planetary bodies and get the precious resources that we're running out of back here at home on the Earth. And to do this, they say they need nuclear power in space. They need it for mining the sky. International space law is now being rewritten to allow corporate control of the planetary bodies. The plan is to scrap the United Nations Moon and Outer Space Treaties so that the corporations can claim private ownership of the planetary bodies. Rovers on Mars today are powered with plutonium-238. In 1989, in 1990, and then again in 1997, I organized campaigns at the Kennedy Space Center to protest and try to block launches of these radioactive plutonium launches into space. And today we hear space entrepreneur Elon Musk say that we've got to move our civilization to Mars. And in fact, the organization called the Mars Society says the Earth is a rotting, dying, stinking planet, and we have to move our civilization to Mars. Imagine the cost of doing that. The militarization of everything around us is indeed a spiritual sickness. Lakota holy man Lame Deer, many years ago, talked about the green frog skin, the dollar bill, and how the white man was blinded by his love for the paper money. His spiritual connection to the Mother Earth was broken. In 1877, the great Lakota warrior Crazy Horse was brought onto the reservation in South Dakota as the Indian Wars came to an end. Along with the end of the Civil War just 12 years before, the military-industrial complex at the time saw an end to its massive war profits. It needed an enemy to keep the production lines going. So a strategy was developed. Journalists and artists were paid to fabricate stories saying that Crazy Horse had broken out of the reservation and was going back on the warpath, killing innocent civilians, children, white children, raping white women, and burning their houses to the ground. These stories were printed in major newspapers across the nation, and the American people were outraged and afraid, and they called upon Congress to do something about it. And of course, Congress complied, swung into action, and appropriated more money for weapons production, while Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull sat inside their teepees on the reservation without a gun to their name. Similarly, in our times, we've seen the military-industrial complex fabricate stories about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And today we see ISIS, which has been trained, armed, funded, and directed by the CIA and Saudi Arabia as the justification for the U.S. to get back into Iraq and to bomb Syria. With so many communities now across the nation addicted to military spending, we need a transitional strategy to deal with the jobs issue, because literally we as a people, as a movement in this country, are held hostage by this jobs issue, as so many people now and so many communities are dependent on military production. Studies by the Economics Department at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst show that military spending creates the fewest jobs, while spending on rail, wind turbines, education, healthcare, repairing our sewer and water systems, and other such things creates more jobs with the same amount of money. Abolitionist Frederick Douglass reminded us that power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. When it comes to our current evil, dark economic system called militarism, we should be talking about its conversion and the jobs that would result from that transformation. Good jobs could be created for home weatherization and building rail systems that would get us out of our gas-guzzling cars. Legions of unemployed workers could be hired to work in town and city organic farms. And as we reject our military-industrial base, we lessen the obvious oppressive war machine on our lives. Without massive cuts in the Pentagon budget, now, immediately, we cannot kickstart our needed social redirection. The integration of the economic conversion issue into the existing work of the peace, environmental, labor, and social justice movements could be a transformative strategy that would unify our disparate efforts and provide the despondent American people with a positive vision for the future. We don't have any time to waste. Thank you very much.
Now for Klondike Inn with Searching for Enemies.
Are at peace. Where do arms merchants go when the nations are at peace? Where do weapons salesmen go when the nations are at peace? They go in search of enemies. Where do all the generals go when the nations are at peace? Where do cold warriors go when the nations are at peace? Where do CIA directors go when the nations are at peace? They go in search of enemies. Some people, they just want to dance. Some people, they just want to eat. Some people are out in business in search of enemies. Are you not my people? Is this not the land of the free and the home of the brave? So who are these ones who drag our name across the seas and go in search of enemies? Do you weigh up the pain? Do you weigh up people's lives? In the face of what you stand to gain, is there anything you would sacrifice? How long do you march down my streets? In search of enemies. Some people, they just want to dance. Some people, they just want to eat. Some people are out making business in search of enemies.
Klondike Inn with In Search of Enemies.
Now we continue with a couple of minutes from Chris Hedges. This is how he introduced his talk, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, which we played over a decade ago in episode 227.
You know, as you heard, I've spent most of my adult life covering conflict, covering war, and I don't do it anymore. I stopped. I ended in Gaza for the second Intifada, or a Palestinian uprising, and got caught in a very bad ambush, which I think I'll mention later. But that was enough. I've just spent most of my life living around a lot of violent death. But I was very angry during the Gulf War, or during this current war with Iraq, because I felt that the images and the way war was being presented was so mendacious and untrue. And I got together with a bunch of combat veterans, including two combat surgeons, four West Point grads. All of us had varying opinions about the war. Some of them actually supported the war in Iraq quite strongly. But what united us was a complete disgust for the way war was being portrayed, mostly by the cable news networks, as a kind of game, as kind of war as entertainment. And there had been a book that came out at the end of World War I called What Every Young Person Should Know About War. It was written by a lawyer named Harold Roland Shapiro. Didn't sell many copies. But he had had, as a lawyer, a client who'd been very badly wounded in World War I and was seeking compensation. So he went back and read the medical records, and he was appalled at what he found out about the reality of war, what he found out in those studies of war, as opposed to the myth or the image of war. And he did this book in a question and answer format, which he then sourced it to the military studies. So we set out and we did the same thing. Now, of course, there's far more studies than there were then. Those studies that he worked on were primarily medical. We were able to draw on a lot of psychological studies. For instance, one of the problems that the Army found after World War II was that only 20% of soldiers in combat situations fired their weapons. So the question was, how do we raise that firing rate? And they brought in Army psychologists to do it, and instead of using bullseye targets, they created human targets that pop up and down. And they employed the techniques in operant conditioning, in essence, the same techniques you use to train a dog, to train people to overcome this natural reluctance most of us have to killing.
Now, a decade ago, when that was made, drones weren't much of an issue in war. Yes, the Pentagon does fund research and development of games which allow people to play in a drone-like scenario, so that many of their drone operators may have been enthusiastic game players, the difference being that what appears to be a game is in fact raining down death on the other side of the world. Some of these points are echoed now by Ben Griffin, formerly of the SAS. He's providing some commentary on the collateral murder video, which was released by WikiLeaks. I've trimmed it very slightly when he's showing the video, and there's minimal audio content. As usual, I'll link to the full source material on this show's webpage at unwelcomeguests.net/706.
One of the problems we've always had when we started to speak out against the war is that people say, well, where's your evidence? Well, when I was on operations in Iraq, I didn't have a video camera, I wasn't keeping notes, I didn't have a dictaphone, and neither did the other guys who were serving. So you've just got to take our word for it that what we're telling you is the truth. However, when Manning copied the Iraq war logs and the Afghan war diaries and uploaded them to WikiLeaks, it gave us and you all the evidence you need as to the true nature of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. After Manning had copied these files, he then became aware of a video. This video later became known as the collateral murder video. I'm going to show you now a shortened version of it, which just brings out the main points in the video. The longer version goes on for about 40 minutes, and I've shortened it to about 5 minutes. If you're interested, I advise you to go onto Google just to type collateral murder, and you can watch the full version. So we're going to watch just a brief edit of that now.
All those people standing down there. Courtyard.
Yeah, Roger. I just estimated
there's
about 20 of them.
There's, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't know if that's
the Bush Met Sullivan, Combat White 6.
That's a weapon.
Yeah. Hotel 26, Crazy Horse 18.
Combat White 6, Bush Met 6, Roger.
Fucking break.
Hotel 26, Crazy Horse 18. Have individuals with weapons.
Radio.
Yep, he's got a weapon too. Hotel 26, Crazy Horse 18, have 5 to 6 individuals with AK-47s. request permission to engage.
Roger that. We have no personnel east of our position, so you are free to engage. Over.
I'm just going to pause it there and just to explain what's actually going on here. About a mile away are two Apache helicopter gunships. These individuals on the ground probably don't even know that those gunships are there. Or they know they're there, but they won't know that they're actually watching them. Not too far away is a ground force with some Bradley fighting vehicles and some infantry on the ground, and they're approaching this scene. Now, this group of individuals here is actually a Reuters film crew. The guy that you might have thought was carrying a weapon, that's actually a camera. So there's a cameraman and a journalist, and they're just out in Baghdad trying to shoot some footage.
All right, we'll be engaging.
Roger, go ahead. I can't get them now because they're behind that building.
Anybody has an element?
We got an RPG.
All right, we got a guy with an RPG.
I'm going to fire.
Okay, no, hold on. Let's come around.
Let's come our point of view.
He was right in front of the Brad about there 1 o'clock. Haven't seen anything since then.
Just fucking, once you get on, just open up.
Yeah, Roger. I see the element. You got about 4 Humvees out along this.
You're clear.
All right, firing.
Line here. Stage line,
let me know when you get it. We'll shoot.
I'm just going to pause there. Now, these Apache helicopter pilots, they would have flown many missions in Iraq, and they would probably know the difference between when an insurgent group is setting up an ambush and when you've got a group of people in the street. If you're setting up an ambush, you're not going to have 15 to 20 guys all hanging around on a corner. There aren't any weapons there. You can probably see that yourself. There are no AK-47s there.
Light them all up.
Come on, fire.
Keep shooting.
Bushmaster 2-6, we need to move time now.
All right, we just engaged all 8 individuals.
Yeah, we got 2 of ours. We're still firing.
Roger.
Got him.
2-6, we're moving.
The men who've just killed those civilians in the street there were under no direct danger themselves. There was no chance of their helicopter being shot out of the sky by these people. The guys in the Bradley and the infantrymen were further down the road there, and they were out of harm's way as well. There was no reason to engage these people. After they'd engaged him and that guy's running off, there's no excuse for killing that guy either.
The Hotel 2-6, Crazy Horse, 1-8.
Oh yeah, look at those dead bastards.
Nice. 2-6, Crazy Horse, 1-8.
Thank you, Spear 02 in flight. 3 chains on 4 at this time.
Spear 02, 3 chains.
Nice. Good shoot.
Thank you.
Now, Bushmaster, we have a van that's approaching and picking up the bodies.
Where's that van at?
Right down there by the body.
Okay, yeah.
Bushmaster, Crazy Horse, have individuals going to the scene, looks like possibly picking up bodies and weapons.
Let me engage.
Hey, we need to stop that. We get down there. We
shoot.
You see my little...
Roger. Break. Crazy Horse 1-8, request permission to engage.
Okay, I'm picking up the wounded.
Those two little circles you can see just inside the front door there, they're two children. And I'd just like to remind you that even though this looks like a battle situation, this is a neighborhood in Baghdad. This is someone's neighborhood. This is where they live. Some people have just been shot in the street, and this person in the van is actually, you know, going about his business. He probably didn't even know this was going to happen. Of course he didn't know it was going to happen. And he's actually carrying out the act of a good Samaritan.
Come on, let us shoot.
A Bushmaster, Crazy Horse 1-8.
You're taking him.
Bushmaster, Crazy Horse 1-8.
It's Bushmaster 7, go ahead.
Roger, we have a black SUV or a bongo truck picking up the bodies.
Fuck.
Request permission to engage.
Bushmaster 7, roger. This is Bushmaster 7, roger, engage.
1-8, engage. Clear.
Come on.
Clear. Clear.
Orange.
Coming around, clear.
Roger. Trying to,
Clear.
Roger, I lost him in the
dust. I got him.
I'm firing.
George, you pushed past the 40. You got any BDA on that truck? Over.
You're clear. This is Crazy Horse. Stand by.
I'm shooting for some reason.
Go ahead.
I think the van's disabled.
Go ahead and shoot it.
I got an azimuth limit for some reason.
Go left.
When he said go left there, that's because he's hit someone else's house. They're hitting the wrong building. It just sort of highlights the danger of being in these places if you're a civilian. It, you know, your own house might get hit just by mistake.
Clear left.
Oh yeah, look at that, right through the windshield.
Just going to pause it there because the tone of the video changes a bit and it brings out an important truth about modern warfare. And that's that it was discovered, well, sort of in the early 20th century, that people are actually quite resistant to killing people, especially face-to-face. When you actually see the human face, it's actually a lot harder to kill. And so there's been a trend over the last 100 years to increase the distance between the kill. And you're having seen that, you know, the death of who knows how many people on the street there, the cool, calm, sort of callous way that the helicopter pilots are talking to each other, they're not affected by this. And now you'll be able to notice the difference when these infantry guys turn up on the scene.
Hey, I need to get the brass to drop ramps. I got a wounded girl. We didn't take the rest of mine.
Magnet radio, aggressive 3-4 is off zone 208 for zone 1. Call for change.
Aggressive 4-3, zone. Correction.
Oh, it's their fault for bringing their kids to a battle.
That's right.
That last... Well, it's not the last statement in that video. It goes on for some time after that, but it kind of encapsulates a certain attitude towards other people's countries. You know, completely getting that people actually live there. He wasn't bringing his kids into a battle. He was driving along with his kids in a van when he witnessed a terrible attack and decided to help the wounded people. Unfortunately, that incident you've just seen is not a one-off. Incidences like that happen all the time in Iraq and Afghanistan, and also wider in Somalia, in the Yemen, in Pakistan. But they're hidden from our view. Just like those helicopter pilots are desensitized by their distance from the kill, we in civilian life, thousands of miles away, bombarded with the propaganda from the state and the military, are insulated from what's really going on in the world. This is really happening. This is happening today. That video also highlights the disproportionate use of force in Iraq and Afghanistan. It was something that surprised me when I was out there. I'd served in Northern Ireland in the 90s. And, okay, you could say that Britain carried out several atrocities in the 70s, which we did. But by the time we were serving in the 90s, the British Army was very careful about how much force they used to make sure that it wasn't over the top, that it was proportionate to the threat that you were facing. And it seems that this has all been thrown out the window now with the use of helicopter gunships in built-up areas. Bradley Manning was so disturbed by this video that he decided that you should see it. He uploaded it to the WikiLeaks website. But that wasn't the first time he tried to upload it. Before that, he'd gone to the Washington Post. And they decided that they didn't want to show this to you. Kind of highlights the mainstream media's complicity in these wars. They want to show you a certain version, a certain... a picture of what's really going on there.
Well, as far as mass media, corporate media is concerned, Wikipedia would seem like an exception, and yet I tend to include Wikipedia. I even go there nowadays when I want an official narrative. I don't expect anything else but the official narrative when I go to Wikipedia these days. It seems to be more tightly controlled than ever. So I went to Wikipedia for the official narrative on Ben Griffin, British Army soldier, and the first thing I saw was a big warning at the top that the page may be deleted due to lack of notability, which brings us to the Wikipedia's notability policy. If somebody is not reported in the commercially controlled media, newspapers and television, then that person is deemed not to be notable. So, to put it another way, if you have the ability to censor television and newspapers, then Wikipedia falls into line. And a host of Wikipedia editors will be there to remove your contribution in accordance with those guidelines. I consider Ben Griffin's decision to break ranks, to not go back to fight in Iraq, to denounce it as an illegal war, to start Veterans for Peace UK, all to be fairly noteworthy stuff. He was speaking at a press conference in 2008, and he talked about a joint US-UK task force responsible for the detention of hundreds, if not thousands, of people in Afghanistan and Iraq, people who were subsequently spirited away to Bagram, Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo Bay, or a host of other such places. So, directly contradicting earlier statements made by Jack Straw and Tony Blair. Now, one might think that this would be of interest to those trying to enforce the laws of this country. Laws which say things such as people should not be imprisoned without charge, people should not be subjected to torture or turned over to other people who are known to torture. These are not contentious points of law, and it doesn't take a legal genius to see that his testimony is of obvious relevance. He might be called in for questioning, perhaps to give a statement under oath about what he knew. Now, 3 days later, he spoke about British complicity in state-sponsored kidnapping, that is, extraordinary rendition by any other name. And rather than exciting the interest of those keen to make sure that the British government played by the rules, within 24 hours he had excited the interest of those keen to make sure that the British government never heard any more of those stories. He was given an injunction and told that he must never repeat these allegations. Ministry of Defence lawyers denying the fact that this was a politically motivated attempt to silence his criticism, stating instead that it was based on his contract with the MOD and what they referred to as the law of confidentiality. Now, we move on to the central topic of drone warfare and the laws, or lack of laws, or are there any laws, the grey area concerning the legal status of using complicated machines to kill people on the other side of the world. Thanks to Wilton Vaught of Other Voices, Other Choices for uploading the audio from the 2015 Interfaith Conference on Drone Warfare to radioforall.net. Our first speaker is Elizabeth Beavers.
As that introduction pointed out, I work on several issues of national security, militarism, and civil liberties, and finding those intersections from a faith perspective. One thing that is central to everything I work on is what we call the AUMF. So I want to talk to you about the story of the 2001 Authorization for the Use of Military Force, the AUMF. I'm going to hone in on that really specifically. So I've got a few questions that we're going to answer here together. The first one is, what is the AUMF? Where did it come from? So immediately after the attacks of September 11th, I think we all remember there was this feeling in the air, this tension, this sort of human desire to retaliate, to answer militarily. And I should stop here, and I'm really glad I gave this talk at a high school, and I said, I think we all remember what that was like. And they were all like, we don't remember. We were like two. So I'm pleased that I'm with people who also remember today. But there was that sense in the air that we wanted to retaliate, and of course, militarism is the way we respond to threats, and that is what is baked into us, and that is our reaction. So here was a really difficult task. I think, as we all know, it is the constitutional mandate, not of the executive branch, but of the legislative branch, to choose when and where to go to war. This is because, as the founders foresaw in their documents, and we can read a lot of fascinating discussion from James Madison and others, that the executive branch is the one that is most prone to go to war. And that is why that check was put into the Constitution, to ensure that there wasn't the singular decision when and where to go to war, when to use lethal force, in the hands of one singular executive. That is why that decision was placed in the legislative branch. So it was the responsibility of Congress to declare war. Now, as we may know, we haven't declared war in quite a while, not officially. What we've gotten into doing is Congress authorizes force. So here was a unique challenge. How do you authorize force in this situation? In those really confusing days after September 11th, there were these questions of, who are we targeting? Where are they? What does it mean to defeat them? So there was a lot of wrangling there among attorneys, among members of Congress, among the executive and others, saying, how exactly do we craft this specific authorization for force in the wake of what just happened? So what they came up with was 60 words, a single sentence. It's been called the most dangerous sentence in American history. I'll read it for you. That the president is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001, or harbored such organizations or persons in order to prevent any future acts of international terrorism against the United States by such nations, organizations, or persons. Does that sound specific to you? So that was passed 3 days after September 11th by Congress. It was hasty, it was quick, there was an urgency. Does anybody know what the vote count was on that vote? That's right. One person voted against it. It was nearly unanimous, and that was Congresswoman Barbara Lee of California. We love Barbara Lee. So I encourage for the high-tech among us, get on YouTube and check out her floor speech of the day that she decided to vote against it, because it was a really moving floor speech. And one of the things that really struck me was she begged her fellow members of Congress, as we move forward, as we act, let us not become the evil we deplore. And I think that was really prescient, because that was September of 2001, and here we are together, 2015. That AUMF is still with us. So let's dive a little more deep. What exactly is the AUMF? We've just read the text. It has no geographic boundaries, no sunset clause, no defined targets, no identification of when this war would be over or when the mission would be accomplished. In addition to that enormous textual sort of blank check, there's been this phrase that has been interpreted into it. I'm sure you've heard it many times, associated forces. Whenever the administration talks about who it is that we're targeting, who it is we're fighting, there's this sort of laundry list of, well, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, this group, that group, and of course, associated forces. What does that mean? We don't really know. There's never been a clear answer. Members of Congress have actually held hearings to try to get to the bottom of exactly what the administration means when they talk about targeting associated forces. We've gotten certain answers such as, there is no official list, per se, of which organizations or individuals are considered to be associated forces. An individual who wasn't even born on September 11th could later in life be targeted by the AUMF because they associated himself with a group who at some points associates itself with Al-Qaeda. Senator Angus King of Maine, I think, had my favorite reaction to the idea of associated forces. He said to an administration official, you keep using this term associated forces. That's not in the AUMF. And you said at one point, oh, it suits us very well. I assume it does suit you very well because you're reading it to cover everything and anything. And you guys have invented this term associated forces that is nowhere in this document. It is the justification for everything, and it renders the war powers of the Congress null and void. Is a really harsh line of questioning there. So I think that's correct. The AUMF has essentially turned the globe into a battlefield. It's very easy for the executive to bypass the legislature and decide to go to war, to use lethal force, to use military force against individuals and organizations. And this is a really novel concept. It wasn't an authorization of force against an established army or a clear-cut fighting force, something that Gabor went into a little more in depth with us. Or individuals can be targeted for their affiliations and their associations. So unfortunately, I should also add that this idea of associated forces has been validated by the court system, largely in the law of detention and what's been happening in Guantanamo and elsewhere. Basically, the AOMF is the legal justification for that indefinite detention that's taking place. The courts have essentially decided that if someone can be targeted, they can be detained. So when detainees challenge that through the writ of habeas corpus, the court has to decide, does the AOMF cover detention of this individual? And unfortunately, most of the time they found that it does. They have used this idea of associated forces to justify detention and included a broad, expansive idea of the AOMF. A D.C. circuit judge recognized this problem last year and wrote in an opinion that The troubling question in these detainee cases is whether the law of the circuit has stretched the meaning of the AOMF so far beyond the terms of these statutory authorizations that habeas corpus proceedings are functionally useless. It's amazing the breadth of the AOMF. So let's talk, why does it matter? What effect has it had to be this broad? Under the AOMF, the United States has engaged in military action in Afghanistan, Iraq, the Philippines, Ethiopia, Kenya, Yemen, Somalia, and many others. As we already discussed, the detention in Guantanamo Bay is justified under the AOMF. Senator Durbin said at one point, none of us who voted for the 2001 AOMF could have envisioned that we were about to give future presidents the authority to fight terrorism as far-flung as Yemen and Somalia. Although I would argue that one person did foresee that. And that's why she voted against it. A former State Department official aptly described the AOMF like a Christmas tree. We just keep hanging more and more and more on it. I like that visual. So how does this relate to what we're all here to discuss, drone strikes? I think you can kind of see where this is going. The AOMF is largely the legal foundation for the targeted killing program for drone strikes. Again, as we said, it's novel in that it authorizes the president to use lethal force not against a nation state or specified army, but non-state actors, organizations, and individuals. It essentially turns the globe into a battlefield. We cannot talk about drones without talking about the AOMF. Reportedly, administration officials, when they decide who it is that's going to be targeted by drone strike, their first question they ask is this person AOMFable? And usually, it seems the answer is yes. Wendy will help us explore this further in her presentation, but I do want to note that the president does, of course, also have inherent constitutional powers as commander-in-chief, and these include the right, the ability to repel immediate threats to the United States. This is a key part of the drones debate as well. But the AOMF allows the president to rely on specific authorization from Congress to justify his actions, and it enhances the scope of those inherent commander-in-chief powers. So while there's a complicated relationship here, the AOMF, it's the foundation of everything. It changes the entire calculus. So what's next? What will become of the AOMF? Will it go on in perpetuity? It's clear at this point that for the AOMF and the resulting drones program to change in any way, there must be active affirmative change in the law. It will not fade out on its own because it is by design an endless war. Let me say that again. It is by design an endless war. President Obama has indicated a desire to change or to end the 2001 AOMF. In a speech at the National Defense University in May of 2013, he talked about fighting terrorism without keeping America on a perpetual war footing. He said, unless we discipline our thinking, our definitions, our actions, we may be drawn into more wars we don't need to fight, or continue to grant presidents unbound powers more suited for traditional armed conflicts between nation states. He then expressed a desire to refine and ultimately repeal the AOMF mandate. More recently, he's called Congress to right-size or to update the AOMF.